ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National. A show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough, and we're here to help you in that moment when you're standing before a shelf in a bookshop or a library wondering what the hell to read next.
From South Africa, Nadia Davids takes us into the life of a furious domestic servant.
Mm-hmm. And Tayari Jones takes us into also the lives of two servants in 1950s Louisiana.
And also, taking us somewhere completely different, we have some genre fiction with romance, blood, storytelling, slasher fiction, some surprising novels to talk about there.
And vampires, Kate. You've forgotten the vampires.
I forgot the vampires.
But BJ Silcox will be here to talk about those, and Tony Birch will also be joining us. But yes, let's turn to the first book, Tayari Jones.
Tayari Jones is an American novelist and academic whose books include Silver Sparrow, The Untelling, and Leaving Atlanta. But it was her fourth novel, American Marriage, that really helped her hit the big time, both critically and in popular sales.
Yes, and American Marriage was an absolute standout hit. And the central premise of it was, yes, it was a marriage, but it was between a wife who had a husband who was imprisoned. And the problems of a relationship like that, set against the background of contemporary America.
Yeah, and the question, would you wait for me? And an exploration, something that she's done many times in her fiction, of the black middle class. But we're going to talk about her latest novel called Kin, and it begins in a small town in Louisiana, a fictional town called Honeysuckle. And it starts in the early 1940s with two small girls, well, babies, really, and they are both, for various reasons, motherless. And we meet both of these girls, Venice and Annie, in alternating chapters, but their early days are really defined by not having their mothers.
Yes, I had that traditional song, Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, going in my head.
Yes,
throughout reading this book. Yeah, the alternating narrative, let's talk about that first. Venice is the first character we meet, Nisi, as she's called. She's being raised by her aunt. Her mother is dead, killed by her father, who then killed himself, although not initially successfully. And she has this extremely desperate need to be mothered, which is not satisfied by her aunt, who had a life of her own and left a man that she loved deeply. He was somebody else's husband, a man in Ohio who was her great love and appeared to love her, to raise this child, her niece.
And she is a tough, hardworking woman. I mean, she's quite an interesting character on the stage, but she's not somebody who was particularly affectionate. She never told her niece that she loved her. So, as you say, she's a child and then a woman who is longing to be mothered, as is the other girl we meet, Annie, the other voice of the story, whose mother disappeared when, well, we're told that she disappeared when Annie was still womb wet. And so at first we think she was only a few days old. And then we're told she was a month old. And then later in the book, we're told she was older still. So the
About a year or something, yeah.
The details miss. But what we do know is that Annie's mother, Hattie Lee, just shot through. there's a different sort of set of stories that circle around Annie, a sort of sense that her mother was, you know,
drunk.
Wild.
Yeah,
a drunk. She was a drinker.
Yeah, and I think at one point there's a reference to her drinking. She was just one of those people who was born like that and would never really be able to slay that beast.
She was trifling. That's the word that's used in the sort of black vernacular that Annie really grapples with.
Her father is unknown and may well still be in the town, and that's another source of anxiety for Annie. So, you know, my first question as we went into this story is will one of these girls' stories become the dominant one? And at times in the passage of the novel, you do enter into the life of one more than the other, but they really are equal, I think.
And they're set up as cradle sisters, that they were put together when they were babies, when they were small girls. So even though their characters are quite different and they move through the world in some different ways, they're connected. So their lives exist in parallel. And so they rely on each other, they're close to each other, they talk to each other, and they've got this shared story of poverty in regional America.
So skipping over a few chapters, eventually they're old enough to need to go out on their own and find a life. Vernice is able to secure a place at a college, Spelman College, which is actually a real place in Atlanta, I think, which was founded in the late 19th century for black women.
And in fact, Tayari Jones went there herself.
As did Alice Walker. So it's a famous place, and so she gets herself there, although not without some hardships. Annie, on the other hand, who's still desperately in her heart hoping that Hattie Lee will turn up and claim her, decides to go and find her. She's last known to have been in Memphis, and so she sets out to see if she can track her down, but falls quite quickly into the company of three other people, a girl and a guy who are in love, and then another guy called Bobo, and off they go in a car that breaks down.
Yeah, Clyde's girlfriend, Baby Doll. I mean, she has a real name, but she's always referred to as Baby Doll. She leaps off the page as a character, I think. She's beautiful, smart, sassy, and they break down. They've got no money, they've got no petrol, they've got this terrible car, and so they knock on the door of a woman who's quite fierce, who's a church woman who looks down at them and says, well, I can't help you, but you can head to this other place out of town.
Yeah, sends her to her sister's house, which is actually a very large farm and also a brothel with rooms, shacks on this property where women are well indentured, really. I mean, they owe money or they can't leave in the middle of nowhere. It's grim, grim, grim.
It's really grim, and you get the sense that there's nothing growing there and that these little buildings, which of course makes you think about plantations and slavery as well, that they are all wearing out. And one of these places, even though this is a realist novel, one of these buildings does have a ghost in it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so their destinies unfold, I suppose. Their characters are the forward motion of the novel as each of them are presented with obstacles.
And it's quite pacey as we're going through the lives of these two young women and we see what's happening to them. But of course, it plays out in different ways. Questions of ambition and respectability, class, and class divisions in the black community are explored so powerfully for Niecy, because there she is in this college that is all about activism and education and marriage and wearing the right stockings and how you behave. And then Annie is the wild one who's working in bars, but they're both still defined by the lack of a mother.
Although Annie isn't really wild. She's the softer and perhaps weaker of the two. She doesn't have the ambition, the drive that Vernice has to get out of Honeysuckle. She's on this quest and allows her own destiny to get mixed up with others and thwarted. And she's also a very good girl because in this place full of their word whores, her job is to read the Bible aloud on Sundays to them, you know, and she's very conscious of maintaining her sense of her bodily integrity.
She's a vulnerable character, isn't she? Mm. I mean, even in that she's always looking for this lost mother and she's going out to places and into suburbs that your heart breaks for her.
Because there are glimpses and references and people might have met her and there might be this address, their last known address, or people say she looks so much like her. So this mother's always just off the next page.
And people are suspicious of this quest as well because she'll confront people who she thinks, you know, and basically she's saying, are you my mother? Are you my mother? To the point that people are going, like, you've got to back off. You've got to stop doing this. And so I felt so strongly for her.
Along the way, they meet quite a number of characters, and that's the other thing this novel is doing. It's building up a picture of what isn't the Underground Railway, but it has the memory of that in the back of its mind. So each time they come across someone, either they are able to help them with some little kindness or some bit of information or a bit of refuge from the weather, or they don't. And each of them forges their destiny through the people they meet. And so the book's called Kin, and it's a very expanded notion of kin because, as we know in the history of slavery, one of the most precious things you could possibly have was an idea of who you were, where you came from, and even your name. So those are the stand-ins for blood relations in this novel and in, I guess, that culture.
Yeah, so you've got made families and chosen families and this sort of haunting idea of these lost and abandoned children all through it as well. And it almost entirely takes place inside black communities. And whenever there is contact with white America intruding, it's never a good thing.
Doesn't end well. But just back to that, when Venice gets on the Greyhound bus to go to her Spelman College.
With her new luggage.
All her luggage and her hand-sewn dresses that she's been saving up for and has made herself. She has a hat box with her lunch in it. And not only is it her lunch, she's put in enough there in case another black person she meets on that trip has no food and she's able to give it to them. So it's not only a kindness, but also a insurance of that being repaid to her sometime down the track. So, yeah.
And all of those little details are so well done, you know, being in a waiting room and there's nowhere to go to the toilet, and all of those little decisions that everybody has to make and that they're making collectively and looking out for each other. I thought that was really powerfully described.
Yeah. So what did you make of the book overall?
I felt like it was very easy to engage with. It had quite a sort of a momentum, and the sort of ideas behind it that captured me were the questions of class and the way that that was played out within the black community. Even the idea of resistance and the politics of the 1950s was then sort of modified by this sense of who could afford to be part of this resistance and what it meant to stand up for things as opposed to just living your life in the best way that you possibly could. I thought that was done with subtlety. What about you?
I liked some of the characters' softness and emotional intelligence. That was a real standout. At times I felt like, is she writing this novel deliberately for screen adaptation? Perhaps it's just because there has been a slew of films in the last decade of this period of American history told through black eyes that I was thinking that. And maybe, you know, I'm doing her a disservice by suggesting it. But I did feel like there are a few characters like the kindly woman, madam in the whorehouse.
She that kindly?
Oh,
she's a bit mean.
I think she was as kind as she knew how to be to Annie. You're just a few things like that which felt like they belonged to a kind of American songbook version of this part of their history.
And there's all sorts of side characters who are quite powerful, and I'm sure there are all sorts of nods to an American history that, reading it in Australia, we might miss. But the book is called Kin by Tayari Jones, published by Penguin.
Well, time now on the bookshelf to welcome this week's guests. Tony Birch, poet, novelist, professor of Australian literature at Melbourne University, and also BJ Silcox, writer and critic. Hello both.
Hello.
Hello.
So how's your reading life been? Before we get onto the books we're talking with
no
you.
No spoilers, of course.
I've read the book that I think will be my book of the year. And Ooh. It will be very, very hard to beat. And I'm just so excited to talk about it when we get to recommendations at the end.
Oh, wow. Okay, that is exciting. It's something to look forward to. What about you, Tony?
Oh, I've read, am reading the oral history of one of the coolest men on the planet.
Are we going to have to wait? Is that going to be
yes,
the,
you'll
hang on till the end
yeah,
of the show?
Yeah, this is why people will keep listening.
Ah, love it. I didn't convince you to read the 900-page dragon novel, Tony.
It's beside my bed and it's actually collapsed the bedside table.
Oh, really? So this is a recommendation from last month that hasn't flown?
No.
All right, well, those cliffhangers later. Let's get to the books that we've all read together.
We're going to talk romance, vampires, speed dating, slasher fiction, but we'll begin in A House on a Hill in 1920, where we meet two women and some ghosts, Cassie.
Sounds good. Nadia Davids is a South African playwright, novelist and short story writer. She won the Kane Prize for African Writing in 2024. And she grew up as part of the Cape Town Muslim community, which is sometimes referred to as the Cape Malay community, which has a history that's, well, stretches back centuries and right back into the Dutch history of colonialism in Africa, but also Indonesia, of course, and to other histories of slavery. Now, her latest novel is called Cape Fever, not to be confused with Cape Fear. Kate, Tony, you've read this. As we always like to ask, where are we and when?
Well, it begins in 1920 in a supposedly unnamed colony in an unnamed place. But to me, I read it as Cape Town and South Africa. It's centred on the life and experience of a young woman named Soraya, who's working as a domestic servant for an English woman called Mrs. Hatting. Now, Soraya is the voice of the novel. She's 19 years old. She's been in service since she was 12. She lives in an area known as the Quarter with her family. And we learn more of that backstory and about her community as the novel goes on. Really important things are set up for us from the first lines of this book. Soraya tells us immediately that she, this is a quote, comes highly recommended to Mrs. Hatting through sentences I tell her I cannot read. But she can read, but her mother told her to keep this quiet, to keep some things back. She's not very comfortable writing, but she can read. So, Tony, what does this secret set up for us with Soraya and her relationship to Mrs. Hatting?
Well, I think it sets up an incredible psychological drama between Soraya and Miss Hatting. And because the power of writing seemingly sits with Mrs. Hatting, who believes that Soraya can't write, is that reading and writing become vital to how their relationship, how their, what we might call their tussle, plays out throughout the book in a very devious way at the hands of Mrs. Hatting, who feels she has the power over her servant because she has this technology of English and writing that her servant doesn't have. But of course, we know, as we do know immediately, as you've just spoken about, Soraya does understand the written word. She does understand English, so that tussle between them becomes a real psychological drama. And without giving anything away, as the novel moves on, we clearly get an insight into what is happening in regard to how Mrs. Hatting attempts to manipulate her servant through the process of this letter writing. And it's not to give anything away to say that it's really about her, one, wanting to control the life of Soraya and ensure that she keeps Soraya in service, so that Soraya's life is really centered around meeting the needs of this elderly colonial woman. So the drama is played out through that. There's also a really important, what we might call a love interest, or the fiancé of Soraya, I think is Nua with as the pronunciation, and that becomes very important to the novel. So it's really about how these two women have this tussle in this house in which Soraya is a servant, around this control and secrecy around writing.
And what I really love about this novel, Tony, is the way that because we're told, we enter this story through Soraya's perspective, we get this young woman who is outwardly quiet and obedient and doing all the work of a servant, but inside she's raging and she's resistant and she has this extraordinary eye. I mean, as she meets this woman and is working out what her work is going to be, she looks around the house and she assesses it. She sees that it's not as wealthy as Mrs. Hatting makes out, and she then sees that she's going to have to collude in this whole world of deceit and hiding things and playing these sort of games of respectability.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's a wonderful attribute of the novel, as you say, that, you know, it's whether it be dust, whether it be having to fill the cracks in windows with newspapers. I mean, this colonial matriarch, Mrs. Hatting, it's a classic case of what you might call sort of colonial asset rich but cash poor woman. And this is often the case. People often aren't aware that in colonial societies such as South Africa and certainly such as Australia, you get people who may, in Australia we would call the landed gentry, and we get people who are the sort of coming to the end of the reign of wealth in some of these colonial homesteads, etc., that people would know. And this occurs in Australia similarly around 1920 or a bit later in the Great Depression, where we actually find people living out quite poverty, if not poverty stricken, very poor lives in these grand mansions that are falling apart. And you get that sense in Mrs. Hatting that she fears falling apart herself, in the sense that her status in society, she certainly has control over her servant, but there are also other, of course, wealthy European colonial people in her circle. And one, I think, of one of her great anxieties would be, one, if she can't have this young woman serve her interests, look after her, feed her, keep up the pretense of wealth, that she will fall back as well. So there's the anxiety is around her relationship, with not only a woman of colour, but also of her status within her own, the colonial hierarchy.
So it seems to me there's a transition of power happening on two levels here, although I'm not sure that Soraya's ultimately powerful, but she is in her youth over this woman. But also there's a transition that's underway socially in South Africa in the 1920s.
And it's done so beautifully because we see the way that this is being controlled, both in terms of the future that Soraya is moving into, where this woman controls her life more and more. So at first, Soraya expects that she'd be able to go home and live with her family. And Mrs. Hatting says, no, you have to stay here. Oh, you can go home every second Sunday. And then as the story goes on, this woman takes more and more control of her time and her life. But it also sort of feeds back into our sense of the complex history of this place as well. The history of slavery, of ownership, of even of Mrs. Hatting wanting to say, you know, it was my people who ended slavery.
I mean, it is interesting to consider that was just raised about Soraya, whether she has power or not. I think ultimately she does have power. I think what's really complex and interesting is you do sense that power shift. And as Kate has just alluded to, that Mrs. Hatting wants Soraya to go home less and less. And in fact, in the end, she doesn't want Soraya to return to her family at all. And she certainly doesn't want her to continue her relationship with her fiancé. That, I think, though, indicates incredible desperation in her. So in other words, her authority or her self-worth or her understanding of her own lack of wealth is that clearly she is a character in this novel who is incredibly anxious about losing power and losing control. And you do sense that as the battle becomes more intense in the novel, that you do see a shift in the power relationship between the two women.
And it's almost bubbling up underneath. There's a sense of the sort of ferment and resistance in this society that's there as well. I mean, at one point when Mrs. Hatting is talking about the great things that the English members of society have done for people like her, for your people, which is how she keeps on referring to the Malay community, you then get the voice of Soraya saying, "Something, no, someone whispers in my ear, amok, amok, and again, amok, amok." Mm. And that English word that we use
Malay.
To mean... Malay word,
yeah.
And so there's all of these things sort of filter up, even Soraya as a storyteller and Soraya as somebody who sees ghosts. Tell us about the ghosts, Tony.
Well, I think the ghosts are really interesting because I'm not a writer who's a big fan of so-called magic realism, which itself is a fairly hackneyed term these days. But when you write, say, ghosts or spirituality into a novel like this, the only thing that matters is about plausibility and authenticity within the story. So what I mean by that, when Soraya sees what she calls the grey women, I think it's Fatima, the older woman who'd been a housekeeper before her, is that within the novel, it's completely believable and acceptable. And the way that I read it and the way I read this, I think, in relationship to the way that First Nations writers in Australia, particularly female First Nations writers in Australia, would often similarly write stories about the impact of ancestors as living ancestors in their lives. What we need to understand is we don't need to wonder whether it's literal or not. It's the important cultural, spiritual, social and intellectual value that those forebears bring to us. So what I sense in that when I'm reading it is these women who have passed that Soraya engages with in the house, they are, you know, ancestors who are there to help protect Soraya through this terrible process of having to serve the interests of this woman. Can I just add an analogy here with Australia? In the 1870s in Victoria, most Aboriginal people had been forced onto missions and reserves run by government or religious agencies. One of the claims of the government was that young Aboriginal people would be given a limited education, and the statement was made, as long as they can read or write and know what to do and follow instructions for work and labour, that is all the education they need. One of those educational tools was language, and that children were taught to read and write English from a very young age on the missions. And what is remarkable is that by the 1880s, just before the so-called infamous Half-Caste Act was introduced into the parliament, these children who had learned to read and write in English were young adults who demanded rights for Aboriginal people. They petitioned Queen Victoria. And the Reverend Bulmer, who was the manager of the Lake Tyres Aboriginal Reserve in Gippsland, he wrote to the Chief Secretary, said, "The greatest mistake we have ever made here is to give these people the power of writing." It's remarkable the way that enslaved Indigenous communities, disadvantaged, you know, in the case of domestics, have learnt to use this technology and understood how powerful it can be and understood how it can be used to provide agency. And I think it's a remarkable history that I don't think enough people know about.
It's reflected so powerfully in this novel.
Yes.
As a sort of piece of post-colonial writing that is full of resistance and complexity as well as characters, because these aren't ciphers. I mean, these characters all work as individuals who are, you know, it's 1920, so there's the whole shadow of World War One and of grief and of lost boys, and then of this whole Muslim community that is routinely underestimated, but which we see as a really complex place. I really do think this is quite a remarkable novel.
Tony, Kate says it's a remarkable novel. What about you?
Well, I'm a writer. I save, you know, remarkable for when I'm looking in the mirror, and only then. I think it's a great novel. I read a lot of novels, as we all do on this show, and I think I've had an experience in the last couple of years where I always, of course, want a novel to succeed. I'm a reader and I love books. I want the author to succeed. And I found books that I've read recently that I've began reading them being a little doubtful, and as I've gone on, that doubt has turned into disappointment, and I feel really disappointed for the writer. With this book, as it began, I thought, oh, this seems okay. The book just got better and better as it went along. And I can say that at the end of the book, it was one of those, almost the greatness of the book snuck up on me. So in other words, while I was reading it, I was really enjoying it. But then when I got to the end, I thought, wow, this has been a great, great book. So, and it's classic of a book, of course, that will stay with me, a book that I want to hand on. I think this will be a book that I'll talk about outside. So in my so-called academic life, I'm already thinking about how this book would influence some of the things I might want to say around colonial power and things like writing and First Nations writing. So I think it'll have an impact on me intellectually as much as it does as a reader.
Okay. That sounds extraordinary. Yeah. Where is she in her writing career?
I think this is the first book to be published outside of South Africa. So it's been described as a sort of debut American novel, but of course she's not a debut writer. She's an established short story writer and playwright. And it really makes me want to explore more of her work.
Okay, well, that is a big wrap from both of you. You better take notice. It's called Cape Fever and it's by Nadia Davids.
This is ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf with me, Kate Evans, with Cassie McCullough, of course, and with guests novelist and poet Tony Birch and writer and critic BJ Silcox. And we're turning now to two new works of hyphenated romance fiction, rom-com slasher and a paranormal vampire romance novel.
So in a way, they're kind of romance slash slasher. And yeah, so look, let's put all our cards on the table from the outset, BJ Silcox. I don't read genre fiction much. Maybe I did a bit when I was younger, but I just don't really have the time for it anymore. What about you?
I'm passionate about it. I really love it. I really care about it. I really think we should advocate for it. And I'll put my cards on the table too. I had a cunning plan. These are the books I chose. I was going to bring them in and I was going to extol the virtues of genre fiction and show you through why they were so wonderful, why we should talk about it and why we should take it seriously. And they're both dreadful.
Oh,
and so,
hang on.
They're both dreadful. They're not dreadful because they're genre fiction.
Oh, really?
They're just dreadful books. Oh. But I love genre fiction. So I have a whole manifesto that I have written this morning. I sat down and I wrote a manifesto about why I care about genre fiction, why I love
this
it
is great.
So dearly. It has like 18 points to it, but I'm going to try and give you the Cliff Notes version. Okay.
So I went into reading these books thinking this is what BJ's really into. This is going to be great. You know, yeah, she's handpicked these books. And you know what? I kind of liked them.
Oh, that's great. I'm really glad you liked them. I felt like my cunning plan came and bit me on the flat bum. Look, genre fiction should be taken seriously, and not taking it seriously is often not just a form of snobbery, but a real form of kind of misogynist snobbery, of just gendering and saying, well, it's chick lit, and we have a big section called chick lit, and we don't have to take it seriously, and we don't have a section called dick lit, and we should. But genre fiction is serious work. It's a moral laboratory. It doesn't just reflect our values. It stress tests them. It's where our cultural anxieties turn up first. If you want to know what a culture cares about or is anxious about or is scared of, you should look for what its monsters and its maidens are doing. It's where our marginalised voices push hardest and first because they can reshape the genre because the kind of the veneer of literary respectability is gone and so they can experiment.
Yeah. But that is really counterintuitive because when I think of genre fiction, so let's just lay it out because, you know, so people know exactly what we're talking about. Romance.
Romance, horror.
Detective novels.
Detective novels, fantasy.
Fantasy, everything from fairies to, you know, sandals and swords and
all of that.
Right.
Yes.
So it's not necessarily about women. Genre.
Not necessarily at all.
It's not necessarily really about the marginalised. So
no, but that is where women and marginalised voices take risks and it's where they have fun. It's where we have fun and fun really matters and it should be taken seriously because they move markets, they shape norms, they influence conversations around consent and reproduction and identity and it shapes millions of imaginations and that's not trivial.
Okay,
and
so because they're popular culture, they're actually reflecting changing mores and standards and
not reflecting them, it's where it's all happening. It's the fermenting cauldron of where it's all happening. And that's what I think is really exciting about it. It's where you should look to see what the change looks like. The culture catches up to genre fiction. And you can see that, like Sinners just got the most Oscar nominations for any film on earth ever. And it's a hybrid vampire film. The culture has caught up to the things that writers were doing 15 years ago on the page, or 50 years ago on the page. So genre fiction is a really exciting place to see what we care about, what we're afraid of.
So because it's market driven, it is at the, excuse the term, bleeding edge.
It is at the bleeding edge, but it's not just about market, it's about fun. It's about being removed from the expectation that it complies with our notions of what seriousness is. It's
allowed and betterment.
To be, and betterment. It's allowed to be sexy. It's allowed to have sex. It's allowed to be sensual. It's allowed to be grotty and dirty. You're allowed to eat people. Cannibal Lit is amazing, this allegorical space for politics, for extractive economies, for meat markets, for women's bodies. All this stuff is happening. I'm so passionate about it, and I know that I sound like I'm polemical, because I am polemical. All this stuff is great. Like, romance fiction isn't just about love. It models about what partnership would look like, what compromises we should make, who changes and why, who's redeemed and why, our expectations around persistence and jealousy and grand gestures. Fantasy makes power visible. It's speculative ethics. Body horror interrogates reproductive politics and medical authority and gender dysphoria and disability and aging and who controls your body and who owns it and what happens when you don't. All of these things are happening in genre fiction.
And we do and have engaged with all sorts of examples of it, especially things like body horror here on the bookshelf. But Tony Burch, as somebody who also teaches writing, I wonder if you could respond to the idea that this is a form where experimentation and playfulness and fun can happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, just firstly, I haven't taught any genre fiction at all, but it's huge. The interest is huge at my university, at Melbourne University, and I know that it's taught in the creative writing program. So it's sort of driven by the fact that young people want it. I think it's great. I think the issue with genre fiction for me, while BJ was I think applauding genre fiction, BJ.
I am.
Is that, I suppose that one is a question, but one is a response. One is a question is that I was thinking about what I do read that might be called genre fiction, and it is, I read a ton of crime fiction, but I wonder if it's regarded as more, and I'm using the term in inverted commas, say serious crime fiction. So my favourite crime writer is an English writer called David Peace, who did the Red Riding trilogy, a very dark trilogy around the Yorkshire Ripper, but written in a, not a literary way, but certainly a different way that you might call popular fiction. But I want to say something here about the Twilight series of books, that those books, I remember when my younger daughters got an interest in those books, I had the cheapest summer of my life because I bought each of them the four books in the series. They spent 6 weeks reading them and rereading them. And then I took them to the first Twilight movie, and it is clear that these young girls at the time, probably I think they might have been 13 and 11, their understanding of themselves as young women through the characters in these books and through, of course, the character on the screen, it really had, I would say, an incredible empowering impact on them. So those books, and I'm sure the way that BJ's talking about other issues around society and culture, they are necessary and they're incredibly valuable. So I love the fact that they loved reading those books. They got so much
drugs.
Out of them.
They're gateway drugs.
Yes.
Okay. This is the context in which I now understand what I've been reading. But let's cut to the chase. Here's the setup of How to Kill a Guy in 10 Dates. Jamie and Laurie are best friends, flatmates, but also lovelorn. So they decide to go on a speed dating night. Now, Jamie has a side interest in going to this because not only is she a fan of the rom-com genre of film, she's a film student, she's also a fan of slasher movies. And these two things are what she's writing her thesis about. And in the very first pages, we get a little taste of her thesis. It's called All's Fair in Love and Gore, the Intersection of Romantic Comedies and Slasher Films in the Late 20th and Early 21st Centuries.
And that's not a bad title.
It is pretty interesting, I thought. And I thought it was going to be right up BJ's alley. Anyway, so, you know, we get a page and a half of that. And then Laurie just says, sorry, Jamie, this isn't really working. So that's how it starts. It's ironic. It's a nod to the discussion I think we've almost just had about genre fiction. But then they charge off to this speed dating night, and it's in a nightclub. Before long, things start to go horribly wrong.
So Jamie's thesis, and this is the reason I picked this book, because I love that conceit. Jamie's thesis is rom-coms and horror films are built on the same overlapping set of rules, which is that women have to behave correctly under pressure in order either to survive and not get their heads sort of hacked off or to be loved. And they're similar rules about behaviour under pressure and about the way in which you make yourself small and less of a target. She sort of puts those rules to work in this speed dating situation, because it turns out that amongst the men who are sort of vying for her affections is in fact a serial killer. He locks down the speed dating, starts to kill people, and Jamie, because she understands both the rules of romance and the rules of horror, is uniquely equipped with the rules of both genres to navigate her way out of that situation. And I was really excited, like deeply excited about that very metafictional idea of saying they're these genre tropes, they talk to us about how women are expected to behave, shrink themselves, how being alone is dangerous. This is all here. Will Jamie be able to survive?
Yeah, so they're halfway through their 10 dates. Everyone, there's 10 guys and 10 women. They do 5 and then they're supposed to have a little cocktail again and then do the other half. But just as they're getting to number 5, the lights go out.
Da, 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 da. And Jamie's on a terrible date with an awful man and he ends up getting his comeuppance.
Yes, as the lights come back on, he's staring at her, but not with dreamy eyes. In fact, his throat has been slashed and he's bleeding to death. This is where the chaos ensues. But handily, because she is such a student of the slasher movie, and this is everything from I Know What You Did Last Summer to Scream to, you know, that one with the chainsaw in Texas, everything, you know, she begins to realise the rules of those movies might just save their life. And it's lucky that Jamie has actually put a poster on the back of the bathroom door in the flat that she shares with Laurie, outlining
with those rules.
With those. But we don't get them in order. We get them completely out of order, these rules. But the first one is don't split up.
And of course they do split up.
Don't run up the stairs.
And they do run up the stairs.
Turn on the light.
And they don't turn on the
light. Always hide longer than you think. Look, it goes on and on and on.
Definitely don't have sex.
Yeah, no spoilers. We don't learn that one until much later on, even though it's number one on the poster. So, look, I have never seen the word blood written so many times in one novel. We were awash in it. At one point, Jamie's high heels mistaken for Louboutin shoes, which famously only have red soles because she's been wading in so much blood. And we still don't know who the killer is. But there's two guys that kind of caught her eye. One is funny and humble, and the other is, well, you describe Wes, BJ.
Wes is smouldering and he doesn't seem to care for her, although maybe he does because he keeps making eyes at her and he wants to protect her, but maybe he doesn't. And, oh, God. And we know it's going to be one of them. Of course it's going to be one of them. I ask myself...
Well, one of them that gets together with her or one of them who's the killer?
Both. Both. We know it's going to be both. And at some point, once her name has been spelled out in somebody's entrails, I wrote, I'm done, in the margins. And that was 160 pages before the end.
So because I thought you liked it, I found all this great stuff in it and I enjoyed it and I found it strangely compelling and whipped through it. Let's turn to the other book we have shared, Aubrey Wants to Die.
Yes, and don't we all want Aubrey to die too?
Oh, so cruel. She's a lovelorn vampire, 150 years into her stint, still looking for love, still wrestling with how to eat and not kill, but looking drop dead because she actually is dead, gorgeous while doing it.
Well, and I have read, just to jump in here, I have read some vampire novels, and for some reason I couldn't care less about zombie novels, but I can engage with vampire novels. Part of it is because it can be a way to do historical fiction. So she's 150 years old. So do we learn interesting things about her origins or how she's moved through a changing world?
No. No, she's 150 years old.
Yes, we do.
We
do.
Don't, Cassie. You know you're starting to quibble with a book when you start looking up, when was glitter invented? Was electricity around? Is Aubrey a girl's name in 1870? Like, you know you're pulled out of a book when you're quibbling with it historically. She's 150 years old. 150 years of reading and cultural soaking and existential wrangling and historical collapse and reinvention. And she sounds like she was born 25 years ago. And all of that layered depth and dark imperial majesty, she has the kind of menace of a houseplant. I wanted to shake her because there's such rich historical detail in there, all of the things that she could have seen, all the things she could have done. She's needy, she's whingy, she's petulant, she's emotionally exhausting, she's mostly friendless, she doesn't want to live, we don't want her to live, and the only thing that gives her life is the fact that she meets the right boy. But then she sends him too many text messages.
The genre,
no,
BJ,
she
you
sends
can't
him,
have your cake and not eat it.
Oh, I have my cake. Anne Rice, 50 years ago this year, Anne Rice wrote Interview with a Vampire, and it was morally searching and existentially dark and very sexy. And she would be turning in her crypt right now if a vampire novel hinged on whether or not the vampire got enough Instagram likes. I'm so angry about this. But can I say that last 30 pages of this book almost redeem it, because it actually does something really interesting and really dark and quite fascinating in the last 30 pages. I read those last night in this great glut, and I was so excited by the last 30 pages that I wanted to stretch them across the whole book. So I'm really torn because I hate her. And then actually she becomes a great character and I sort of want a sequel to happen. So I'm in this really horrible mix about it. This book does almost land it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to stand up for Shaylee Thompson and How to Kill a Guy in 10 Dates just one final time. I thought the most interesting part in that book was when she thought that Wes might be the killer and began to get that spine tingling feeling. She was getting other tingling feelings as well. And then she stopped to analyse it, that once he became a potential lethal threat was when she saw something really special in him. And she then analysed it. I liked that. That is edgy.
I wish there was more sex. I'll be very honest. I wish there was more than light frotterism in both books. I wish there was a lot more sex. That would make it more fun.
There's another genre, you know, it's called pornography. But anyway.
That's no, pretty... genre is a lot of fun for sex. But you're quite right.
I mean, if that's what you're going to it for, why? You know, why not just go straight?
Because
I made this clumsily couple of weeks ago, this point. If it's the pornography, why do you dress it up with a story?
Yeah, but you made that point about fantasy, and I thought it was a total misrepresentation of what fantasy fiction does.
Come on, everyone.
Sex is part of life. But sex is part of life and part of storytelling, and why is the minute that people rub up against each other, we say it's dirty and we put a little box?
Tony!
Yes?
They're ganging up on me.
Okay, well, I'll just tell you, I've never written sex into a novel. What I say to my students is that most sex is written badly, and this is my sex story. We went to the pictures, we went home and we had a root. So I don't do it. But I do think that point about pornography and why not just go to it, I think my feeling would be if you say not pornography but sometimes see what you might call movies that have a lot more explicit sex in them, it does work best when there's a story around it, I think. Because I think pornography, part of it being incredibly boring, or a lot of it, I always say this, not that I've watched them myself, but it becomes boring because there's no story and there's no character.
Yeah.
And genre has both of those in spades, or usually does.
Well, we have digressed. I, for one, enjoyed a little excursion into the kind of wacky world of genre. Thank you for choosing them, BJ.
I have a huge list that I will happily give anyone of things that I really deeply love that are not these books.
But the books that we were just talking about, or the focus of the discussion, was Pip Knight's Aubrey Wants to Die, published by HarperCollins, and Shaylee Thompson's How to Kill a Guy in 10 Dates by Atria Books. Well, thank you both for those very spirited discussions of those books. We heard a little bit earlier about what you've both been reading, and now we want the answer to the big question. Tony Birch, reading a book about the coolest person of all, what's the book, who's the person?
Well, the book is called Dancing Through the Fire. The author technically is Dan Jennings, but it's an authorised oral history of Paul Weller, of the Jam and Style Council. And the It's a long book, 700 pages, but the interviews are remarkable, from his parents, childhood friends, through band members, etc. I am, of course, a Weller fan. He dresses wonderfully. I love reading about musicians. It's a wonderful book to read about what it is that really gets someone to begin to consider themselves someone who wants to be a musical artist. And what you find in this book is what I've read in several biographies of particularly working class artists who have come through, say, from the 60s onwards, particularly in the UK. They're working class, and it's always you find someone in a family. In this case, it's Paul Weller's father, who not only buys him his first guitar, but becomes this sort of, he's a taxi driver and a bit of a shifty, but he becomes their manager. And it's just a wonderful story about parents, both his parents are very great, how their kid wants to be he wants to be an artist. He doesn't want to, you know, go to university, and they just back him all the way. That's the part of the book that I loved.
Wow, Tony, you surprised me, and I would never have thought Tony Birch, Paul Weller, fanatic, but that is fantastic.
The very cool Paul Weller. BJ Silcox, it's the book that you've loved the most so far this year. What is it?
It's also a pitch for Books Pages. I know that we lost all the Washington Post Books Pages last week. I would only have read this book because there was a little review in The Guardian UK. It's a debut novel by Rebecca Perry called May We Feed the King. The review was so enamoured with it and did such a wonderful job of setting out why I should give it a chance. And I would never have done it had I not read the review. It's a little novella in three parts. And the first part sets up the kind of this wonderful idea, and it's such a conceptual idea. It's from the perspective of a person who puts together the reenactment dioramas in historical buildings, and they've been asked to reenact a particular king. Their job is to set out the food and the drink and the clothing, to set out a narrative in plastic and allow you to step into the world and see what their life might have been like. And it is a meditation on the virtues of a plastic artichoke and what you can learn about someone from a chicken leg. I never, ever would have thought that I would love this book so much, but it's sort of, it's about what can we tell about a life if you set out just the clues of a narrative. And then it goes back in time to give you that king's story or most of it, and then flips back to let you experience the diorama and create the narrative ending for yourself. And it's very short and deeply poetic. Rebecca Perry is a poet, but it took me to a place I never expected to go, and I was totally just ensorcelled by the whole concept of it and the whole idea of the suspension of disbelief. It reminded me a lot of a book I read a couple of years ago called Painting Time by Maylister Caringal, about a bunch of art students who learn to reproduce sky and wood. They're trompe l'oeil artists. And that, again, is about creating these sort of fake environments that trick you into believing you're part of something. And I think I'm just really caught in that idea, and it's sort of metafictional in of itself. But I loved this book so dearly. It's gentle and it's quiet, and it's about our own imaginations and how they fill in the gaps.
Mm. The recreation of imagined lives. So one word answer, BJ, if and when there is a diorama of your life sometime in the future, what is the food item that will be enshrined in plastic?
Cup of tea. Mm. My husband makes me a cup of tea every morning to entice me out of bed.
Kate, what about you?
It'll have to be a bowl of fur.
Ah, Tony?
An ice cream.
Cassie?
Mine's a half-eaten avocado going brown on the kitchen bench. Wow. Well, thank you for your excellent and, heartfelt reviewing, both of you.
It was a pleasure to be here.
I was wonderful to be here with BJ again. I hope she gets over the trauma.
It was my own stupid choice. I created a rod for my own back.
Yeah, that's a genre.
Yeah, my own stupid choice.
BJ Silcox and Tony Birch. And of course, as always, we list every book that's mentioned on our program page. It's a labour of love from our producer, Sarah Corbett. So use it because it's there for you.
And that's it for this week's edition of The Bookshelf. Next time, Mothers and Daughters in Danish cult writer Helle Heller's They. a mountain climbing novel with Gabriel Tallent's Crux, and from Australia, Claire Thomas on Not Climbing Mountains. So it seems, Cassie, we've got accidental rocks to climb on the bookshelf next week.
Ooh, spooky coincidences. Okay, well, see you next time.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.